intelligence consultant work on intelligence. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Jeff Hawkins.
Thanks. I'm going to just stand here if that's okay. Everyone can hear me right? In the back there? Yeah, I don't need the mic. So, all right, I'm Jeff Hawkins. You got that. This book, which I'm now an author, it's called Unintelligence. I'm not sure about that. It's a book about, not about computers, this is what I'm most concerned about, but it's a book about frameworks and what they do and how they do it. It's a real theory of intelligence, and it's a biological theory, a functional biological theory about how the human cortex works. It's a pretty ambitious book, because it's really trying to solve a very major problem, which I'll talk about today. I do have a co-author I want to mention, it's Sandra Blakesley. Now, she is a science writer for the New York Times, and she's perhaps the best-known science writer in neuroscience. Most neuroscientists know her. I worked with her because I wanted to make the book readable by a general audience, and it covers a broad area of a broad field of topics, and it can be a very technical field, and you know, we didn't want it to be a very technical book. So she really helped in doing that, and I think we accomplished a lot of what we wanted to accomplish there. So tonight's talk is not very technical. This is not a venue for doing technical talks. I'm going to give you a description about, there's plenty of seats here if you want your seats over there. Don't be bashful. You can leave at any time. I'm going to give you sort of a broad overview of what the book is about, the theory of a computer science book in here on Stanford campus on February 28th, at 4:15 p.m. And that'll be a more in-depth and more technical talk with slides and pictures and things like that. So, if that done, let me just tell you how this book came about, and that's a little bit of my personal history, because you might be thinking, oh, what's a computer guy writing a book about brains? Do I know what I'm talking about? And then we'll go into the basics of the theory and what it's all about. So, I studied AA when I was an undergrad, and I started working my first job at Intel in 1979. It was a much smaller company then. And 4 months into my first job, I decided I was going to change careers. And that's because in September of 79, there was a number of things happened. But one was, it was an issue of Scientific American, which was dedicated to the brain. And as a kid, I'd always been interested about the brain, but there was a whole issue of Scientific American, every article about the brain. And I read it very carefully. It talked about the neuron and about diseases and evolution and so on. And the very last one was written by Francis Crick, one of the co-discoverers of DNA, who I got to know later in life, and unfortunately just passed away. But Francis wrote a piece called Thinking About Thinking, in which he said, well, this is all well and good. We have all these details about the brain, but we don't know diddly squat how it works. And his exact words were, what is conspicuously lacking is a broad framework of ideas within which to interpret all this data. So there was no framework. We had all this detail, but no place to put it together. And that was true in 1979, and it's still true today. That there are no large-scale theories about brain function, and it's something we're trying to correct. But anyway, I said this. This is amazing. This is a great problem. It's one of the greatest problems anyone could work on, understanding how the human brain works. I said we have all these details, but we don't have a theory. And so, gee, how hard can it be? You know, the young kid. But in some sense, it's not that hard. It's hard to figure things out, but it's generally not hard to understand. And so I said, look, if we really apply ourselves, this is something we can solve in my lifetime. So I decided to dedicate my life to theoretical neuroscience. I tried three approaches to do it as a career. First was, I was working at Intel, and I tried to get Intel interested. And I went and talked to Gordon Moore and Ted Hoff and other people, and they basically said, nah, we're not really interested in doing this. They didn't really think what's going to happen in the near future, and they were correct. Then I was living in Boston, I applied to MIT. MIT had an AI lab, and I was a computer science guy. So I said, oh, great, they want to build intelligent machines. I want to build intelligent machines. I just want to understand how brains work first. So I went there, and I applied to a graduate program in AI. But they told me that they didn't like the approach. They said, but there's no point in studying brains. Brains are just like computers, and you just need to program computers, the question I had earlier, to make intelligent machines. And I said, I don't believe that. I don't think that's going to work. And they said, well, we don't interested in having you as a student. So a few years later, I was living in Northern California, and I was now working at a company called with systems. I was still in the computer industry, and but I was going to somehow get to study the theoretical neuroscience, one or the other. So I got myself in the biological, took a biological approach, and I got myself enrolled in a PhD program in biophysics at Berkeley. Now, I was living right next door to Stanford, but at that time, this is 1986, there was very little going on here in neuroscience at Stanford. There was almost nothing in biophysics. There was absolutely nothing in theoretical neuroscience. At least Berkeley had a fairly big biophysics program, and so I made the commute up there. I'd much rather be here, but it didn't work out. So I got into that program, and I started studying brains, and I had some real insights, some of which are in the book, and I wrote them up as a thesis proposal. And it was circulated among the neuroscience faculty, and it was actually reviewed very favorably. Unfortunately, though, they said there's no way you can do that as a graduate student. So I was very naive. I didn't really understand what this academia thing was about. But as a graduate student, you have to work in someone's lab, and you have to do the work they're doing. And if there's no one doing anything like at all what you're doing, you're in the wrong place. Well, that turned out to be the case for me. No one was doing very large-scale cortical theory, and it was not possible for me to do what I'm doing. So I was encouraged to do something else related for a number of years, then do a postdoc, and then maybe get to do what you want to do. And I said, no, I can't do that. My wife wanted to start having a family. I was earning nothing practically, as maybe some of you probably know. And so I decided I was going to go back in the computer industry for 4 years. I said, I'll just take 4 years. I'll make enough money I can afford to be a student again. I would learn a bit about, I had a specific task, learn how to change institutions, because I figured I was up not just against a science problem, but an institutional problem. And someone like myself really wanted to study what everyone agrees is a great important topic, and you couldn't do it, something was wrong. And I figured I would mature, and I figured neuroscience would mature, and that would become more accepting of theoretical approaches. This all happened, but it took didn't take 4 years. It ended up being more like 18 years. And along the way, part of the problem is along the way, I had a lot of success. I started palm computing in 1992. I started Handspring in 1998. I'm the chief technical officer at Palm One. I designed the original Palm Pilot. I designed, architected the Trio smartphone and so on. I still do this work. But throughout all this time as an entrepreneur, I was working part-time. And the other part of my time, I was doing neuroscience, and I had a lot of friends in the neuroscience community. And a few years ago, a number of them convinced me, against my will, against my desire, my initial desires, to start a neuroscience institute dedicated to large-scale theory, brain theory. And I did that about 3 years ago. That's called the Redwood Neuroscience Institute. It's in Menlo Park, above Baroni's Cafe. And if you find this talk fascinating, you can go look at RNI's website, and we have talks and flyers where you're welcome to attend. So we have a small neuroscience institute, and that was to really work on theory of cortex. And in the process, that's been going on a little bit over 2 years now. And over the last 2 years, a lot of progress has been made. Tremendous amount in the book. And so it turned out I started writing this book at the same time I started making this progress. So that's how this all came about. And I really had these two jobs, like the Walter Mitty kind of guy. I do this, my day job is designing computers because I really couldn't get the job I wanted. So, waiters waiting tables, that kind of stuff. I was designing computers. Okay, so that's the story here. Let me just tell you the basics of this theory and then some of the implications for it. I'm going to start with this little guy. This is a model of a brain. This is not a real brain. I'm going to get a real brain one day, but I'm not sure how legal it is to carry one around. This is a plastic model. It's also a great way of stopping the airline screeners because it's a big plastic thing with metal pins in it. It doesn't go through the skin. But if we could roughly, this is going to be a very approximate, so we can roughly divide the brain into two parts. It's a part that we might call the old brain, which has been around for a long time, that you have, and that reptiles have, and things like that. And that's sort of like the center, it goes up the center, it's like a post. And then there's the new brain. The new brain is the neocortex, and when you look at the human brain, it's this wrinkly thing on top. Now, the neocortex is where it's all happening, as far as humanity is concerned. This is the location of everything we think about as high-level thought comes out of the neocortex. Language, math, planning, art, music, visual perception, auditory perception, somatosensory perception, all happening in the neocortex. And in humans, the neocortex is really big. And so my work has been focused on the neocortex, because that's where intelligence lies in many, many respects. So if we were to take the neocortex out of your head and remove it, which would not hurt, by the way, because your brain is the only part of your body that has no nerve endings in it. So it wouldn't hurt to remove it. Okay? You would probably not think very well there. But if I were to do it, it would look like this. This is a model of the neocortex. The cortex is about 1,000 square centimeters, so the large dinner napkin is about the right size. And it's about this thick. It's only about 2 millimeters thick, a little bit thicker than this dinner napkin. And this sheet, which is, gets crumpled up to fit in your head, that's why it's all wrinkly. It's a thin sheet that gets folded, like when you're stuffing a napkin into a wine glass or something. That's how it fits in your head. This sheet is everything in your life. It's about 30 billion cells, 30 billion neurons, I should say. 30 billion neurons, roughly 300 trillion synapses, which are connections between neurons. And those neurons and those synapses are containing all of the memories you're aware of. Everything you can tell me is stored in here. All your knowledge about this campus, about your family, your friends, your home, how dogs behave, what kind of food you've eaten in your life, all that's in the neocortex. Everything, language, everything you know is pretty much in here. There's some memories that are not in the neocortex, but you really can't recall them, like how to ride a bicycle, things like that. But pretty much everything you know is in the cortex. And now, there's two amazing facts about the cortex. They're amazing mostly because they seem contradictory. There's chairs up here. They're contradictory. First fact is that it turns out that the cortex has regions that do different things. This is very well established. The different areas in the sheet of cells in your head do different things. There's an area involved in vision. There's an area involved in audition or hearing. There's a motor area, which is making my mouth move right now, and my hands. There's areas for language and for mathematics, and a lot of science these days, there's a lot of different ways of determining this, but there's different areas that seem to be involved more heavily in this thing than that thing, and a lot of imaging science going on these days, fMRI, is determining what these things are, where these different regions are. So that's pretty cool. We know this from many years of history, that the cortex is divided into functional regions. Now, the contrary thing about the cortex is the following. If you actually just look at the sheet of cells, and you take a little section of it in a microscope, you see there's a lot of structure there. There's about 6 layers of cells. They have different cell types in each layer. There's different specific connectivity between the different cells. There's a lot of structure in the cortex. And yet, everywhere you look in the cortex, it looks virtually identical. There's a few small exceptions, but we'll take for the starters that almost everywhere looks identical. And it was speculated in 1979 by a physiologist named Bernard Mountcastle that it turns out that he said, look, I think the same thing is going on everywhere. That the regions, you know, the way the cortex does language is exactly the way it does vision, which is the way it does mathematics. He says there's a common cortical algorithm underlying all these things that we think of as high-level thought. This is a really amazing amazing speculation. It seems hard to believe. It is true, and I'm not going to prove it to you tonight. It's true. I've tested a lot of biologists about it. About half of them believe it. And about half of them either choose to not believe it or ignore it, because it just seems too hard to believe. But there's a tremendous amount of evidence, some of which we talked about in the book, to point out that actually there is a common algorithm. So how can the same thing be going on, how can you be doing the same different functions in different areas, but using the same process, the same algorithm to do it? It's a beautiful result of nature, and it's also something that comes out of evolution, because the cortex evolves very rapidly. It hasn't been around for a lot of long. People say, oh, it's the pinnacle of evolution. Baloney. It showed up recently. It only exists in mammals. And non-mammals don't have it. Only mammals have a cortex. And it hasn't been around long enough, and it's gotten really big recently with higher mammals like ourselves. And when that happens, it hasn't been around for a lot of evolutionary pressure. Nature made it big by just replicating a common element. And that's how it got like that. So we have these two things. We've got functional regions, and we have a common algorithm. How could this be? How can this be true? All right, I'm going to answer that question tonight before we're done. The first thing I want to point out is, what does the cortex do? We have this innate notion that we think we know what we do. We think we all have a brain, right? I think everyone has one here. So we think, oh yeah, well, I see the world and I think and I do stuff, right? The inputs come in and I think and I process and I do something. Not true. It's not so simple. Let me tell you. Now, first of all, remember that the cortex was a recent invention. So an animal like a reptile, like an alligator, doesn't have one. But an alligator has senses just like you and I do. It has eyes and ears and skin, very much like you and I do. It has fairly sophisticated behaviors. It can run and hide and sleep. It has sex. It can fight. It has emotions. and so on. And so you don't need a cortex to do all that stuff. So what good is a cortex? What's the difference between us and everything? Well, the basic theory here, this is the idea I had back in 1986, which is now actually becoming fairly well accepted in the neuroscience community. Many people thought of the same thing, is that the cortex is not about taking input and producing an output like a computer does. It's about making predictions. It's about building a model world and making predictions. It's a memory organ. This is a memory organ. It's storing the memory of your world as you experienced it. And it builds a model of the world, and the goal of the cortex, first and foremost, is making predictions. Let me just try to describe this to you, what I mean by predictions. First of all, I'm not talking about your conscious level predictions. Most of the predictions I'm talking about things you're not even aware of. So I'm going to touch this lectern over here. And I'm not even going to look. I'm going to put my hand down. And I have an expectation of what it's going to feel like. And I know that because if my hand didn't stop and it just kept going, I would have been very surprised. I would have gone, whoa, and, right? If it felt funny, if it felt like jello and wiggled, I think I would have been surprised too. If it was just metal and it felt cold, I would have said, gee, that's not what I expected. Now, I'm not thinking this when I put my hand down here. But your brain is doing this. Your brain is doing this because you know if anything changed, you'd notice it. Every time you take a footstep, you put your foot on the floor, you have an expectation of where it's going to stop and what it's going to feel like. If my foot traveled an extra quarter or an eighth of an inch beyond what it normally does, I think there's a hole in the floor. I go look down, there's something wrong. And if it felt different. Now, you're doing this all the time in your waking life. You're not aware of it. So as you listen to me speak, you have expectations about what my voice is going to sound like, what part of the room it's going to come from, or if you speak English, what word is at the end of this sentence. It came to your head. Your brain has predicted. You can't predict accurately 100% of the time. It's a probabilistic prediction, but it's predicting all the time, trying to say what's going to happen next year. And you do this in vision, too. You're not aware of it. But as you look around the room, you have expectations, visual expectations. You expect walls to be generally perpendicular and not to move. You expect light to bounce a certain way. But you're not surprised at all to see the trees outside waving in the breeze and so on. You have visual expectation, you have physical, sensory expectations, and auditory expectations. And it's very coordinated. And your brain is just doing this all the time. Now, what's the advantage of this? Imagine you have a little lizard and you have a rat. And they both got an old brain, but the rat's got a neocortex, a little bit of neocortex, about the size of a postage stamp. Now, the difference is that you put them in a maze, they both scurry along, they do something, they find the cheese or whatever you can feed rats these days. Probably cheese, juice, something, I don't know. He goes through the maze and he finds the cheese. Now, the rat has a memory system sitting on top of the old brain. And literally, as the patterns come into the old brain, the rat is memorizing what he's seeing. It's like a little recording. It works in a special way. It's like a little recording. Now, the next time you put these two animals in the maze, the rat, neocortex, is going to be looking at the patterns coming in. And the neocortex is going to be sitting there going, wait a second, I've seen this before. I recognize this pattern. I remember this thing. Here's something similar. And I'm going to play back what happened in the past. It literally will feed into the rat's brain and a visual expectation or some sort of expectation about what it's going to feel and see and hear next. And the rat makes more intelligent use of its existing behaviors. It basically says, oh, I can see into the future. I know which way to go. And I can visualize the cheese. You do this all the time. Every time you walk into any room you've ever been in before, you have an expectation of what you're going to see. And that's being fed back from the cortex. So it started out as a memory system that builds a model world and then feeds predictions into the old brain. Now, in humans, something uniquely happens. With humans, first of all, our cortex got very large. We have a very big model of the world. And I'll explain a little bit how this model works, how the memory works. But we have a very big memory. We can remember a lot of things. But then so can a dolphin. A dolphin has a very big brain. He can remember a lot of things, too. We're pretty similar in that way. But humans, uniquely something else happened. In humans, what happened is this cortical memory system, because I haven't described how it works yet, but this cortical memory system, which is used to make predictions, can also be used to generate motor behavior. And in humans, we connected more of our motor system to the cortex. Same algorithm that's used to make predictions is now actually driving motor behavior. It's a beautiful synergy between these two. But this is unique in humans. If you look at a human brain, if I remove the part of the brain which is the motor cortex, you're paralyzed. If you do that in a rat, you barely notice the difference at all in behavior is that. Because all you're doing in the rat is you're sort of removing its sort of conscious expectations about the world. But you're not changing its motor behavior. In a human, our cortex has taken over much of our motor behavior. So my cortex is driving my mouth muscles and my throat right now, where no other species has the ability to do that. So uniquely, humans have this very large model of the world, plus we have a very sophisticated motor generation in which lethal language and other things like that. Okay, so how does the cortex do this? I can only give you the basics here in this talk. If you took these regions of cortical sheath, different regions, you say there's a region here and a region here, you'd find very often two regions are connected together. That is, a big bundle of fibers comes out and into the next section. Millions of fibers. Big wires coming out in the axons. And when you find A connects to B, you find B connects to A. That's almost universal. So there's all these regions and there's a lot of this common connectivity going back and forth. But now it turns out when A connects to B and B connects to A, they don't do so symmetrically. They do so asymmetrically. Because you can tell that one pair of connections is different than the other pair of connections coming back. And that asymmetry leads to a hierarchical organization of these regions. You can say at the bottom of this hierarchical tree, we have the sensory input regions, the visual input, the auditory input, the somatosensory input, and actually the motor output. And then you can say what regions are connected. You can actually, well, this region's above this one, this one's above this one. And we're talking logically. Of course, they're all in the same sheet here. They're not physically hierarchical, but they're logically hierarchical through their connections. And there's a hierarchy. It's almost like an inverted, you know, it's a pyramid of these all these cortical regions connected. So, and it's the hierarchy which is the key to understanding how this whole thing works. Now, I'll just give you a flavor for it. But you have a section of the hierarchy which is vision, there's a section of the hierarchy which is auditory, there's a section of the hierarchy which is somatosensory motor, or touch and motor control. And they converge to higher up. So there's areas of higher in the hierarchy that are sitting basically getting input from all sensory modalities. So there's visual and auditory, visual and somatosensory. And the basic idea is the patterns come into this thing, which are coming in from your senses, from the old brain. That first of all, they form memories. But once the memories are formed, as the patterns come in, they recall past events. And they do this in this hierarchical format. So as the information flows up the hierarchy, it also recalls and flows back down the hierarchy, leading to predictions at the low level. So you have actually driving back what you're going to see and feel here next. The trick to the hierarchy, just give you a very quick sense of this, is that each section of the hierarchy, each section of the cortex, is in essence memorizing sequences of patterns. You can think of a sequence of patterns like a song. A song is a sequence of patterns. You can't think of a song as a spatial pattern. It's a temporal pattern. It only exists over time. It's meaningless without time. And so, you know, note or interval follows interval, note follows note. Well, it turns out that's what the world is, how you experience all the world. When I move around the world, as you move around the world, as you hear the world, as you feel the world, it's all about time. Even vision, your eyes are constantly moving. And each region of the cortex actually stores sequences of patterns. It's like storing little song segments. Now, if I was a region of the cortex, you follow me so far, you got the visual pattern in your head, hopefully, all right? If I see any nods out there, I see a couple nods out there, that's good. So I'm just a little region of this cortical sheet, and I'm somewhere in the hierarchy. And I'm getting all these patterns coming into me. And by the way, it's just patterns. Right? There's no light entering your head. There's no sound into your head. It's just these electrical patterns coming in the brain. And I'm looking at these patterns. I don't know what they mean, but I see sequences of them. I see things like a song. I say, oh, there's this pattern that occurs over and over again. It's a consistency. It occurs over and over again, like a song. And if I do that, what I'm going to do is I'm going to say to the guy above me in the hierarchy, I'm going to say, you know what? I'm getting a series of notes here. But I'm not going to tell you about all the details. I'm just going to give you a constant pattern, the name of the song. So here's the name of the song. I'll take care of the details. And as long as I can predict the next note, I'm happy, and I'll just tell you, here's the name of the song. You just get the name. And to the guys below me in the hierarchy, I say, you know what? I'm in the song right now, and here's the next note. You guys down here, here's the next note, here's the next note, here's the next note. And when you put this in a hierarchy, what you do is you have a memory of sequences of sequences. You have the very low of your little sequences, and they get combined. So give you an example. Little short patterns become, let's say, phonemes. And phonemes becomes words. And words becomes phrases, and so on. Literally and figuratively. Same thing with song. But you're doing this with all your sensory modalities. And so as you go up the pyramid, you have more and more constancy over time, because you have higher-level concepts at the top that when they come down, they get unfolded into more and more, details, unfolded and unfolded into very complex patterns. So I say to myself, Jeff, give a brain toss. Right? That's a pretty high-level concept. And then I come here and I can rattle on for 40 minutes, right? Because I start with a very high-level thing which unfolds and unfolds and unfolds. And in my mind, I'm saying, oh, the brain talk begins with an introduction, the background, you know, blah, blah, blah. There's like five sections. And each of those sections unfolds into another section, and so on. And this is what you do when you memorize a speech, or memorize almost anything. So the cortex works in this hierarchical of sequence memories. And I'm not going to leave it at that tonight, because anything more than that requires some pictures and some diagrams and so on, which we don't have time for tonight. But you can basically, you can see how the whole thing hangs together. It hangs together beautifully, actually. And you can understand why there's a single core for algorithm, because what makes the vision read vision is because the eyes are attached to it, and what makes the hearing hearing is because the ears are attached to it. But it's doing the same basic process and building the same sort of patterns and representations as we go up. Now, I'm just going to talk a little bit about some of the consequences of this theory. Once you get into this and you understand how the mechanism of this is, you can explain a lot of things we think about as this sort of human behavior. It has a very concrete explanation for what creativity or intuition is. I'll just talk about creativity. Give you an example of this. If you're a brain, if you're this guy here, this your cortex, and of course you are, just pretend you're thinking. And all these patterns are coming in. Well, it turns out, if I look at the patterns coming from my neurons, there's a million fibers, a million wires, a million axons. And not once in your life will you have the same pattern on those million fibers. You could look at my face 1,000 times, sitting right in front of me, go look, jump, and it won't be the same. The light changes, you move a little bit, you move a little closer, you move a little far away. It seems the same to you. This is what the volume of the caught AI. This is going to be easy, right? Really hard. It seems the same, your percept is the same, but the pattern coming in the brain is actually very different. It's not at all the same. Now, we just think it's the same. The point of this is that throughout your life, you'll never have the same input pattern coming in your brain. And the only way you recognize anything, the only way these memories work, is it basically works by analogy. The memory you formed is a sort of we call an invariant memory. It's a memory of how the world is, not exactly how it appeared. You don't have a flash memory like a picture. You remember the structure of the world. And as patterns come in, you say, this is similar to a structure I've seen before. And I'm going to assume it's the same one. And now I'll make a prediction about it. I think it's the same thing, I'll make a prediction about it. It's prediction by analogy. Let me give you another example. When you're listening to music, your memory of a song is not in an absolute key. You don't remember the actual notes you learn the song in. You learn the relative structure of the song, those are the intervals. And we know this because when you hear a song in a new key, you've never heard it before, played with completely new notes, you've never heard it before, it sounds exactly the same to you. It's not like you've ever, you don't even think you have perfect pitch. You have perfect pitch in your different pitch. But most people don't. You don't have any idea what original key sounds like the same song. So completely new pattern, you see it as the same. So, and you can pick the next note, even though you've never heard this particular rendition before. Now, you're doing this all the time. So you're making predictions by analogy to the past, not by exact matching to the past. Now, when we do it at a lower level, like hearing a song that we never heard before, and a song we've heard before but a different key, we think of it as, we don't think of it as anything special at all. It's just, it's a new key, it's a song, and I predict the next note. And I've never touched this lecture before, I don't think it's very specially creative. But when you do this at the top of the cortical hierarchy, you're still doing the exact same thing. You're making predictions by analogy. But the analogies are more far afield, and it's a creative process. So if you're a mathematician and you're looking at some equation and you're stuck and you can't figure out how to solve it and you rearrange it a few times and then all of a sudden you go, this looks like, the blah, blah, Boltzmann equation I saw 5 years ago. And you say, if it is, I'm going to be able to solve it the same way. And then we try. And you try by analogy to the past. You try to solve this thing. We do this all the time. We say, I'm raising kids. I say, maybe raising kids is like raising dogs. Because I've raised dogs as a kid. Selling a political idea is like selling a computer is like selling a scientific idea. Maybe I should apply the same process to it. And these are sort of higher level creative acts. But it's the same process. We can understand what an expert is. It turns out when you have memory in a hierarchy like this, if you practice a lot, what happens is you relearn these patterns lower down the hierarchy. This is what practice does. It brings these memories lower down the hierarchy. And it leaves room at the top. And at the top now you have sort of, you're able to look at sort of higher level sequences, higher level concepts that you wouldn't be able to do otherwise. And that's what makes an expert. And it can even explain a lot about what consciousness is. Because consciousness is intimately related to the formation of memories and expectations. And I won't get into that, but we can do it later if someone wants to do it. I have a few more points about this book and the theory in it. First of all, I want to emphasize this is not a book about AI. The book talks a lot about how you can build intelligent machines. And the last chapter is about that. I'm very excited about it. But it's not a book about AI. It is a book. It's a book about biology. It's a book about brains and intelligence and how that evolved and how it works. And then I go into saying, well, yes, once you know that, you can now build the stuff. But I've had some people misunderstand that. This is not an AI book. It's a theory, a biological theory book. The second thing I want to point out with the book, it's not completely new. Most of the ideas you'll find in here, not all of them, there are some novel, pretty novel ones in there, but a lot of the ideas that are in the book have been around for a long time. They've been, you know, if you study the neuroscience literature, you'll find out that, first you'll find that you can't study the neuroscience literature because it is huge. I went to a neuroscience conference recently in San Diego, and there's 32,000 neuroscientists. 32,000 neuroscientists. And this goes on year after year, and they all publish papers. I mean, there's a hell of a lot of data. And so every idea has been thrown out sometimes. What's new in this book is putting the pieces together. It's building a framework, as Francis Crick talked about in 1979. It is not, you know, inventing some new metal of physics or something that's playing, or, you know, quantum mechanics is playing out my answer. No, the pieces have been there. The pieces have been lying around. The trick was just, you know, which pieces do you ignore, which pieces do you pay attention to, how do you put them together to form something interesting? And so, you know, I think if you go back and look at the history of science, you see this is a very common thing. That, you know, your real sort of major movements in science are not created out of whole cloth. There are some times that that's the case, but very often it's not. The ideas have been around for a while. So that's not new. The last thing is, the reason why did I write this book? You know, I didn't want to be an author. It's a lot of work. I don't know if you're authors here, but boy, I tell you, writing a book is a lot of work. Even when you have help, it's a lot of work. But I had a very specific goal because I want to bring both neuroscience and AI into sort of the next century. I want to bring them into a cohesive framework. And I'm trying to create a movement. There were movements behind AI. They were big fields. For those who are old enough to remember, there were thousands of people who got to be studying AI. There were degree programs and companies were formed and all kinds of, you know, all kinds of journals and so on. Some of the still lingers on. But it really didn't go anywhere. And the same thing happened with neural networks. And in the mid-80s, there was a big movement there. Again, sort of petered out. But I think it's time for another movement in real building, real intelligent machines, or understanding brains. And I think we have enough knowledge now to do that. So I'm actually consciously out. The reason most of my talks I've been doing for this book is actually very few I do book talks. Most of them are doing on sort of, you know, computer science or neuroscience, philosophy type of stuff. Where I'm trying to grab, you know, basically entice young people, students to work in these fields. And I'm having some success with that. And getting quite a few people who actually say, I want to work on this, I want to do it. So I hope that wasn't like a dawn for me or something. I'm really almost done. So the last two points I want to point out. If you like what I'm talking about, read the book. Sure, buy it. You can get it at the library too, I bet. So I'm not, you know, we're in bookstores, buy the book. But that's not what I'm here. I'm here to sell an idea. And I'd like you to, if you're intrigued, find out more about it. You can read more about the book on the book's website, which is onintelligence.org. There's a forum there and some more information about the book and what people, other people said about it. And then again, I'll remind you of the February 28th talk. So I'm going to now stop talking and take questions. And thank you. Yes?
Hey, Jeff. I'm a master's student at Stanford.
Yes.
And I'm just curious if you think if machines say become intelligent or conscious, that would that be a dangerous thing?
The question is, by building intelligent machines or conscious machines, is that a dangerous thing? And I didn't write about this because I realized it's a concern. And no, I don't think so. First of all, I'll make a couple of distinctions here. There's a lot of stuff that goes on in science fiction, and there's reality. I'm not interested in building humans. And when I talk about intelligent machines and what they're going to do, and I didn't talk about that here tonight, so I'd be happy to do it, because I talk about length in the book, what they will do, what they will like. It's not like building robots. And it's not even trying to replicate human behavior. You know, the whole AI movement, a lot of it was in the early stages at least, was built around this idea of the Turing test, which was to emulate a human. And, you know, I don't know that will ever happen. I'm not interested in that. And I doubt it's going to happen. It was the wrong goal. The goal was to understand what intelligence is and apply it to new problems. If you want to emulate a human, you got to do the whole brain, not just the neocortex. You got to do the old brain too, and you got to do the body, and, you know, and the sex and the hormones and all that kind of stuff. If you're going to pass the Turing test, that's what that's all about. We're just talking about the sort of the very high level thing of what is, you know, what is perception, what is intelligence. And the machines that you build that be like this will not be self-replicated. They will not be human-like at all. They may not even be they probably, a lot of them won't even have any sort of robotic equivalent to them whatsoever. To me, the most interesting things about building intelligent machines is that you can build them faster than humans, you can build them higher capacity than humans, and you can hook them up with more interesting senses than humans. So it's not to do what humans do per se, but I think it's it'll be very possible to build intelligent machines that look at the weather system, the weather sensors we have in the world, like a big retina. And it'll see weather the way you and I see this room. And it'll be able to pick out patterns in it. Or to have machines think in the higher, you know, things that we find difficult, higher level mathematics and physics, high dimensional mathematics, and so on. And I speculated a bit about this in the book. But none of these things are threatening to humans. When the computer was invented, when the steam engine was invented, and then when the computers were invented, and electricity, there's all these fears that all of a sudden there's these magical powers that are out there, and that we're going to end up with, machines taking over the world. That's where robots came from back in the early part of the Industrial Revolution. But none of that happened, right? None of it happened. But now we have these computers that are dangerous just because they don't work very well. But not because they're threatening to take over our lives. And I think the same thing is going to happen here. And I don't think people are going to really build. This is a long answer, I'm sorry, but it reminded me, there's a whole section of the talk I couldn't give, which I didn't give. That this is not a dangerous thing. And these machines aren't going to feel trapped or emotionally, subjugated to us and want to break out and take over, as good science fiction fodder. But it's not going to be like that at all. Go ahead.
A couple of questions about the neocortex.
Sure.
You mentioned that it's structured in layers where each layer abstracts away details from the layer above.
Yes.
So what happens?
Well, I didn't say that. Let's be careful. I said it's a hierarchical arrangement of regions. But within each region, there's actually six layers. The six layers are throughout the whole sheet. Okay. But keep going.
Okay. So when an input comes in that wasn't predicted, and it can't be abstracted away, does it get bubbled up to the top?
Yes, exactly. But for those who didn't hear it, if I'm a region of the cortex, and I get an input comes in, and I can't predict it, it's an unexpected pattern. Maybe I was expecting something, and I got something different. Maybe I wasn't expecting anything. What do I do with it? And you had the right answer. The answer is, I say, holy crap, what is this? You look at it. And I pass it up the hierarchy. And you can see this in operation all the time. Imagine you're driving home in a familiar room. You just go home at the end of the day, right? It's something you do all the time. And you're in the car, your bike, whatever. You're just going along, and you're not even thinking about it, right? Why aren't you thinking about it? Because, obviously your brain's doing it, right? But the reason you're not thinking about it is because it's being handled very low down. This is a very practiced skill. And so it's being handled lower, hierarchically low down in the cortex. Now something happens all of a sudden. Some naked person runs across the road, or a kid or something, You're gonna notice it, right? And what's gonna happen? Whatever you were thinking about, you think, what am I eating for dinner tonight? What am I gonna ping, right? Something happens. You stop thinking about whatever you're thinking about. And immediately your mind is occupied, whatever that thing was that just popped into your field of view. Now what happened is literally a pattern came in that was unanticipated, could not have anticipated, was out of any kind of memory you've ever had before, and it goes right up the cortex and takes over. It basically goes right to the top and says, whoa, this is what we're thinking about now. Now interesting, a little more technical point, at the very top of the cortex, there's a structure called hierarchically at the top of the cortex. Remember, we're all talking about hierarchies here. It is a structure called the hippocampus. And the hippocampus is a part of the brain which is actually quite old, it's older than the cortex, but it's actually, the cortex is in between the hippocampus and the rest of the brain. And the hippocampus is where flash, or very quick memories are formed. Now this is where you remember new things. In fact, the idea of the hippocampus, this is where new memories are formed, and then they're passed to the cortex. What's happened here is the things that rise up the cortex are the novel things. Things that you couldn't anticipate. And if they're really novel, they go all the way to the top, and that's where new memory in the hippocampus, that's where new memories are formed. Things that can be anticipated, in some sense or another, are not new, and they don't get remembered. You don't remember the details of when you're going home in your car and everything went fine. There's no memory of whatsoever because it got handled low down. But if you saw the pin on the road or the naked lady or whatever, you're going to remember that. And it's going to go right to the top and take over your thoughts, you're going to forget what else you're thinking about, and bingo. So a big part of this is how patterns flow up and flow down, expectation flows up and flows down. That's a good question.
So short-term memory might be in the hippocampus.
The question is short-term memory in the hippocampus. A little bit loaded question because there's all these different types of memories. What is true is that when you form new memories of anything, really, you know, like if I said, you know, what did you have for breakfast this morning, or you know, or even what's my name, or something like that, it'll first be in the hippocampus. If you don't have a hippocampus, you won't remember anything. Absolutely nothing. Zero. It's like, you know, like you're a zombie type of thing. But you remember everything before you left your hippocampus. So it gets up there, and then that's what new memories form. Now, short-term memory is a loaded word because there are these working memories, which people believe are sort of in prefrontal cortex, and so it's a little more complex than that. But if I'm going to say new memories, even if the ones I'm going to forget pretty soon, they go to the hippocampus. Just because it gets the hippocampus doesn't mean it's going to be remembered forever. You'll forget it unless you see it over again or practice it again. So in that sense, it's short-term memory, yes. But there's working memories in other parts of the brain. It's a little bit less. I wanted to take this last question.
Yes, I have this kind of three-part different question. When a baby is born, how developed is his cortex or her cortex? What makes some people smarter than the others? And what actually is an IQ?
Okay. So when a baby is born, this is a bit of this nature-nurture question, okay? So when a baby is born, you know, what's in the cortex, first of all? The cortex has structure to it. Genetically, your cortex has this hierarchy, and it's very specific, this hierarchy. It's not just a blah hierarchy. These are very specific regions that are connected in very specific ways. Now, the actual connections, the details of the connections, are meaningless for the most part. And most of them get changed very early in life. But the basic structure of the cortex, which determines the basic structures of the world that you can learn, you know, starting with the eye, the retina, and then, you know, thinking a lot of the nucleus, and then the visual system and so on. This is kind of wired from birth. There's a lot to this. But there's no details. You don't know anything about language, about anything, really, in the cortex. It's just like a blank thing. Now, the other parts of the brain know some things. You know, they know how to suckle, they know how to cry, they know how to poop and things like that. But the cortex is pretty blank. And then what you basically do is from birth, you start building this memory and this hierarchy. Now, what makes an expert, what makes someone smarter than someone else? Clearly, there are physical differences between brains. Most human brains are pretty much identical. We all have this roughly the same number of cells. Even though we have different sized heads, we pretty much have the same number of cells. So you can't really judge intelligence by head size or anything like that. So we can assume, you know, but there's going to be some genetic differences. You know, Einstein was probably a little bit smarter than most of us somehow. You know, and you can imagine perhaps there's a lot of speculation on why. You know, maybe he had more cells or more regions or there's variations. You know, one of the interesting things about the primary visual area, V1, which is in the back of the head here, which is the largest region in the cortex, actually varies by a factor of 3 in normal humans. And all humans, all these people see pretty much the same, except the people who have a bigger one have higher acuity in some ways. They see more fine detail. I'm sorry, that's not a question, that's a cell phone. So the point of trying to get it, there's a genetic determined hierarchy structure, there's going to be variation in that, clearly, which determines some people are better at some things than others, and then there's a nurture component. Because if you're not exposed to pattern early in life, this hierarchy builds sort of like it's like a foundation. You lay these low-level memories down, the detailed memories down the bottom here, and the new memories that form the top are in relationship to those. So you can only form new memories at the top, basically in the language of the stuff that's already been formed. So if you haven't learned, you know, to write or to read by the time you're 12 years old, it's going to be really hard. And that's true most anything. They've shown, you know, if you want to be a really great musician or great or anything, you've got to start really young. So the advice there is expose your kids to as many things you think that are going to be relevant as possible early in life and do it often. And then your last question about IQ, I have a clue what, you know, IQ is. I don't think that's a... you know, everyone has their own sort of intelligence. You can be intelligent about social things, you can be intelligent about music, you can be intelligent about language, you can be intelligent about math, and it's very difficult to put a single number on any of that stuff. We are all creative, we're all intelligent, some of us have better brains than others perhaps, some of us have different experiences than others perhaps, but certainly those two things are, you know, they're true, there's being different brains and so on, but yes. I'll take this guy right over here first. No, come up here.
Given what we know about the neocortex and the research program at this point in time, in your opinion, is there any room left for volition or free will, or can all conscious experience be reduced to mechanical processes? Well, obviously no one does, yeah. But just in your opinion.
Well, in my opinion, this opinion about what is there free will. And I want to caution the idea that, you know, say, can it all be reduced to mechanistic processes? Because mechanisms are not necessarily deterministic. And there's a big difference there. Computers are pretty deterministic. You design them that way.
Multi-core isn't.
What's that?
Multi-core isn't.
Multi-core isn't. Okay, well, in general, I mean,
already it's not.
We try to make computers deterministic. That we strive to do that. Most computers we try to do that. But my point is that you have a very complex system here. It's working on extremely complex. We're talking 30 billion cells that are talking to each other. They are, the interactions are very short time frames and so on. It's not clocked. It's a probabilistic framework where you can understand all this stuff. So it is not possible, nor will it ever be possible, to say, given a brain, you know, what is the state of a brain? What is its input? What is its output going to be? Never going to happen. But having said that, I think that there is no room for something else. There is no room for, you know, some other thing on the side here which makes these cells do something they wouldn't not otherwise normally not do. There is no, you know, finger of God coming and saying, pointing and saying, you know, don't do that now, do this, because, you know, there's some volition involved with it. And so this problem doesn't bother me. I don't feel like I'm an automaton, you know. I don't feel like, oh, I have no free will. No, I have a lot of free will. I have a lot of ways. You can choose what you want to do in your life. But it's not outside of mechanism, I guess, is I would point. There's no need nor obvious point where something else that isn't biological or biochemical occurs.
Just need a little chaos generator in there. Right?
We need a little chaos. Well, every molecule in the world is a little chaos generator. In fact, right. Every complex system in the world is a chaos generator. You know, when people think like, oh, the planets are not chaotic. They are chaotic. This is on a very long time frame. Since you've got a lot of little cells, they're all chaotic. So yes. So there's like attractors, and then you can't really predict exactly. But we tend to sit in some attractor space. Yes.
Back to a biological question. I played around with some of these ideas, and I guess this is something you mentioned in chunking, or what I'm calling chunking, that you learn to play tennis, and at first it's, you know, high up in the cortex, you can hardly hold the racket the way they tell you to, and after, you know, a few years, you're not even thinking about it, and you're playing tennis. But you're saying these memories are moving down the hierarchy. I can see how you can put things together up the hierarchy. I've put all these complex skills together. I've learned them. How, I guess, physically, do you think these things are moving down?
It's a good question. So the question is, as you learn to become an expert, you imagine you can try to collect all this stuff at the top, and I'm saying it's moving down. How does that happen? Is that,
right.
Yeah. Well, let me give you some evidence for it. So as you become expert, your reaction times come much faster. And it's been shown on many expert tests that there isn't even enough time for the signals to travel all the way up and back down. And in fact, the reason you're clumsy when you first start playing tennis or playing piano or anything is that you have to provide all of your conscious attention to the top of the hierarchy, to go all the way up. You have to think about this thing, what am I going to try to do next? How am I going to do this? And as you practice, you don't want to think about it. You don't want to occupy your thoughts. You want to be more like driving a car. Now,
I believe that happens. I'm just mystified as to how.
Okay, let me explain, I think, how this works. As rough as I can without any pictures or anything like that. It's not moved. I do not believe that the memories are moved. I believe you relearn them. Let me give you an example about this. You learn to read. It's very hard. You start with the alphabet. It's very hard to learn to read A through Z. Anybody who's had children knows you spend a lot of time on this. Kids struggle with it. It's taking all their brains. Now, you form representations at sort of the top of the hierarchy for what the letters are. Now, you practice that in practice. Now you want to try to learn very simple three-letter words. Again, very hard. Children struggle with it at first. Now, for you to do this, actually, for you to recognize a word as a three, you know, through reading, you want to recognize a word as a word, not as letters. You now have to form memories and representations of what a word is. Not the, you know, you're not sitting there counting the letters anymore. That's how you start it. But to learn to read a word, you see the word all at once. Boom. Now, you still have the ability to recognize letters if you pay attention to them. Now, what I'm pointing is I start out with the letters at the top, and now I have words at the top as well. I have words and letters at the top. But I'm going to describe this. There's two regions of the cortex here, right? And they're communicating this thing where I said earlier, like, I know the notes and you know the name type of thing. If you walk through the algorithm, which I can try to do on paper, you walk through the algorithm, but it turns out that the top guy starts forming representations of sequences too. And he starts passing back down things which are more conceptual to the Noller guy. And the Noller guy says, oh, I now have more conceptual frameworks in which to interpret my input. And I basically relearn. I don't forget it, I don't move it. I left the old letters at the top, but as I start learning words, I have to form sort of memories of the letters below it. And it takes a lot of effort and time. And it takes 18 years to raise a child. And one of the reasons I believe is because you have to relearn these things over and over again. It's not like you forgot them, but you have to form new memories further. It's a cyclical process, it's a cyclical process how you do this. And so anyway, I believe you're actually forming these memories lower and lower and lower in the cortex.
That's right.
And it's really hard, the very end. To keep pushing it down, it's harder and harder and harder. And we learn more and more. That's where you become a super expert. You gotta like practice 10 hours a day kind of stuff. Did you have a comment on that?
I mean, is it so mechanistically though? Is it the top level stuff? Is it helping the lower level predict by?
Yeah, the top level stuff does. It's the top level says, here's what you're supposed to be seeing. Here's the name of the sequence you're supposed to be seeing. The next guy below me. And the guy below is sitting there going, okay, well I got these inputs. I now know what framework, what prior, what top down. Prior to saying, how to organize this input. And then I start building those representations of that, and then I pass the name of that up. It's sort of a, I'm passing names both ways, and because I'm always forming these sequence memories, the sophistication of these names change. They kind of represent higher level constructs, and therefore now I'm giving a higher level construct to the guy named Wong. I should come up with good examples of that, but it's hard. I'm going to take the guy in the white shirt in the back.
Okay, thank you. I don't mean to put you on the spot as sort of the expert on the way all thinking works, but you're the first person I've heard talk about this on a conceptual level. What about photographic memory and then, quote, beginner's luck, the idea that sometimes I associate that with, if you go in without preconceptions, you can sometimes open up new pathways that could be more effective.
Let's just talk about this. So the question is, what about
photographic memory?
And what about beginner's luck? First of all, on the photographic memory, I've never met one of these people. I assume they exist. I mean, everyone talks about them all the time, but I've never met one. So the idea of perhaps savants who supposedly have the ability to memorize things or read a telephone book and remember it. I have no idea about that, what that is. Now, what I find fascinating about it, if it's true, always be careful about this. If it's true, is that clearly they have a brain too, and their brain is able to do this. So I find this is really fascinating. So look, somehow if you rewire the brain a bit, and make it an abnormal brain, or it's different than what most people have, it can do something like that, which is pretty damn interesting. Now that's not what you really want in life. What in life we really want to generalize. We want to basically build a model and always predict by analogy. But I find that interesting. So I would love to understand that. I have no idea, and I don't know if it's really true either. Beginner's luck is interesting. This is, I don't know if it's beginner's luck. Can I just talk about intuition or something like this? Again, it goes back to creativity. Prediction by example, prediction by analogy. One of the problems is when we've done something many times, and you see a problem and you're trying to solve it, you're going to try to solve it the same way you've always been trying to solve it. And what you want to do is you want to find an analogy to something in your past which is different. What I do when I want to be creative, when I have a problem I'm working on, the trick is not to work on it. The trick is to every night think about the problem and go to sleep. And then I wake up in the middle of the night and I'm just daydreaming and bingo, things come to you. Or you're in the shower and you go, oh, bingo, It never happens when you're actually trying. And what you want to do is you want to find some pattern in past memory, you need to keep thinking about the problem, but not too hard, and you got to be exposed to all these different things, and then the mechanism basically will say, oh, this is like that, I recognize that pattern. And then bingo, you got it. That's the best I can do with this. Hope it helps a little bit. I'm going to take the guy in the beach here.
Yeah. You have obviously gone through a lot of journals, and is there any effort made to actually influence the electrical signals that goes to the lower cortex, lower level of the cortex?
What do you mean influence?
Or from outside? Is there any study done like how those signals look or?
The question is, do we have a lot of knowledge about how these signals look like when they're coming in? Yeah, trust me, we got gazillions of knowledge about this. It's very, I don't want to pass on your question, I'm not sure if it is a question, but there is a tremendous amount of detail here. I'll tell you an interesting fact up here, maybe just relate to the question. a large number of research has been done about you take an animal, you you anesthetize it so it doesn't move around, and then you record from cells in the cortex. And very commonly what they do, the most common experiments, is record from V1, the primary visual cortex, the first area in the hierarchy of vision. And then they'll take in a cat, and the cat will be anesthetized, and in front of the cat they put some, like, you know, these moving bars, and they find, oh, this cell responds to moving bars, this orientation. And they say, that's the receptive field of the cat. That's the cell. They've done this. This is a Nobel Prize winning work of Hugo and Wiesel and many, many other people. It's done all kinds of ways on this campus as well. And what they found is they have all these very complex things for figuring out the receptive fields of cells. What do cells respond to? But it turns out that much of this research is in doubt, because if you have a non-anesthetized animal and you expose the animal to a realistic scene as opposed to just a little bar or grating going by, first of all, you measure the cells. You say, okay, I think I know what the cell is doing. The cell is doing this kind of, you know, the line orientation at this angle, going this direction. Then you show the cell a real scene, like, you know, a bookstore or, you know, a field. And you say, well, I should be able to predict how that cell should respond, even though I've already characterized it. Turns out they don't respond that way at all. They respond completely differently. It's like a completely different world. And so, you know, because all they've been doing is been looking at, you know, very simple, non-realistic patterns on a feed-forward only mode. But in real life, it's information flowing back, you have these expectations, and you have this all these interactions going on, and so a lot of that work is questionable in terms of, you know, is it really capturing what these cells do? And I think it's all evident that feedback in prediction is a very dominant role here. I'll take a few more questions. I saw this guy and then I'll be back.
I had a question about, I was wondering if you think it's possible in the current way computers are generally architected to get this kind of real creativity, because there's such stark differences where, like, discrete versus analog, highly parallel in the brain versus highly serial, maybe up two processors, four, but yeah, not billions, random versus sequential,
yes.
You know, those sorts of things. But do we need a new paradigm?
So can computers do this? Is that the question?
Can it just be intelligent?
Look, you can't program a computer to be intelligent. What you can't, I mean, that's the point of this whole thing. It's a complex hierarchical memory system, and you got to do that. So I don't believe you can write a program to say, you know, we're going to do the language program. What you can do, you can take a computer and model a hierarchical memory system. So you can program a computer to basically, and this is something that's being done at RNI, actually, an interesting at this point in time, it's a good insight into Dalip George, who's back here. He's a Stanford student. He's doing his PhD work at RNI, and he's writing models of this. You don't talk about this stuff, you can do it. But you can program a computer to model this memory hierarchy, and it can exhibit this behaviors. It's not a very efficient way of doing it. You'd really want to have a special machine designed for this, perhaps, a special memory or whatever, but it works. And these have been actually very good progress in that. So, not that it's conscious and walking around talking, though, we don't get the head, but it's doing a hierarchical representation, and it's doing the sequences and so on. But one of the premises here is that I do not believe in strong AI. I do not believe you can create sort of intelligence or human level intelligence by programming a computer tasked specifically to do that. The beauty of this whole thing is that it all works, it's all the same algorithm. It's not like task specific solutions. It's a memory solution. I have one more question here and then I'll call it quits.
Do you think we can achieve artificial intelligence in a brute force way just by having computer fast enough that can simulate the human brain at the neuron level?
The question was similar to this question, I think. Can we make computers fast enough to create true intelligence by simulating the brain at the neuron level, type of thing? Given the caveat I said before, you can't program the computer to be intelligent. You can program it to be a memory system. Could we do that in a fast enough way to actually create significant intelligence? Is that maybe the question? I think so. First of all, I hate saying the word human level intelligence, because remember, it's not like replicating a human. It's like building machines that work on the same principles, but not being human-like in the sense that they're going to talk to you about what you had for lunch today. And I don't think it's the most efficient way to do it, but you can do it. I don't see any reason why. You know, one of the things to remember is that neurons are really slow. They work in the order of milliseconds. And a neuron can do something, a fast neuron can do something, anything in about 5 milliseconds. Where in silicon, we can do things, a 1,000 times faster or more, 100,000 times faster. And so it's possible that you could do some emulation that on a very fast computer that could read some almost real-time speeds on a biological system. I think that's all mute. I think what will happen is you'll build these things, you'll use existing technology for them, you figure out what they're good for, and then we'll start building application-specific circuits for this and drive some very specific memory systems for it and so on.
So if we can build such a computer, why do you think it will not be intelligent or it will not behave?
If we can build such a system?
Yeah, if we can build it and it simulates the human brain.
Well, if you want to simulate the human brain by modeling the hierarchical memory system, I think it would be intelligent. All right? That's the premise. You're not going to be intelligent, though, by programming the vision section to do vision things and do 2.5D sketches. And here's my language processor. And that's not how the brain works. Right? If you want to build a big piece of silicon with some software that emulates the hierarchical memory of a cortex, it will be intelligent. Yes, I agree, it will be intelligent. Do you understand the distinction? It's a very important distinction between old AI and working in the same way the brain works. Okay, I'm done. I'll be around for a while. I think if anyone wants to buy a book, I'll be happy to sign books. Thank you for coming. And you can come by in some of our talks. They're very technical talks, but you can learn about what we do. Anyway, you can't even take a bookmark even if you don't buy it.
So now, you could be hired in HR. You had an email.
I don't like to leave them now. I have to give one call. Okay, next.